Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Kia ora. Welcome to Conversations with Wahine, brought to you by the Wellington branch of the National Council of Women, New Zealand.
Hello and welcome to Conversations with Wahine. Today you're joined with me, Harita, and I'm joined with Labour MP, Rachel Boyack. How are you going, Rachel?
I'm great, Harita. It's lovely to be with you.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming, especially on your one-hour parliamentary dinner break.
Yeah.
Rachel is the Labour MP for Nelson. First elected to Parliament in 2020, Rachel came into politics from a background in union organising, where she worked to improve wages and conditions for workers across the Nelson region. She's also been closely involved in her local community, holding governance roles with organisations such as the Nelson Environmental Centre and the Women's Refuge. Since entering Parliament, Rachel has taken on a number of responsibilities, including serving on select committees and contributing to work across a range of policy areas. She currently holds the spokesperson roles for arts, culture and heritage, animal welfare and oceans and fisheries. That's quite a portfolio.
Yes, at the moment it's a very interesting portfolio and very much in the public domain.
Yeah, definitely. A lot of things that are on the news quite often at the moment as well. So how has your upbringing shaped who you are today?
Well, I think every politician would look back at their upbringing and see how it shapes their values. And, you know, if I look back on my maiden speech, I talked to that quite a bit. Mm. I moved around a lot as a child and my father worked in a senior role in the health system. My mother was a church musician and a teacher, both quite politically interested. And if I look across my wider family, a range of roles that had public service in them and also, you know, political values and a range of those values.
Mm.
And so I guess for me, I was always kind of in that environment. But also my personality lends me to this type of work. I could be stroppy when I want to be. I've always been quite willing to stand up and speak quite openly about injustice as I see it, call it like it is. Always, you know, never felt afraid to tell people what I think on an issue. And, you know, so I think all of those things combined, it's not surprising actually I ended up going down the political route.
So your family weren't surprised when you told them you wanted to campaign?
No, I mean, I joined the Labour Party, 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. So in my mid-20s, and you know, other members of my family have done things like deliver leaflets for political candidates. Mm-hmm. My stepfather was a deputy mayor of a city council in Palmerston North, and so it was probably just over 10 years between joining the party and then becoming a candidate. So, you know, there was definitely some concern around that at times. You know, you're exposed publicly, you know, you don't get that privacy anymore. You know, it involves a huge amount of work.
Mm.
And, yeah, I think my grandparents never knew that I ended up becoming a candidate. They passed away beforehand. Mm-hmm. I think they would have been both proud and concerned. So, I don't think it came as a surprise once it actually happened.
Mm. And you mentioned before that you grew up, or you actually moved around New Zealand quite a lot. So you grew up in Timaru. You moved to Palmerston North when you were 9. And you went to Auckland University and then you moved to Nelson after getting married and now you work in Wellington. Is that correct?
Well, kind of. I was born in Timaru. Mm-hmm. Then we moved to Blenheim. Then we moved
to... there was Blenheim mix as well.
Oh, and then when I was 3, we moved to Whanganui.
Oh!
And then when I was 8, we moved to Wellington. And then I moved to Palmerston North.
Oh, you really have been all around.
And then I went to Auckland and then I moved back to Wellington for 3 years to work in the public service. And then I moved to Nelson.
Oh, okay. So the internet left out a few things.
The internet
there
probably has. So while I was born in Timaru, I only lived there for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I've lived in provincial centres for most of my life. Auckland is obviously very different to that. And I both loved and hated Auckland. You know, I was there as a university student with no money, so it's difficult.
Oh, yeah.
And it can be quite lonely. I have a couple of family members in Auckland, but most of my family are in Palmerston North and Wellington. So mm-hmm. you know, I kind of didn't feel as close to my family physically as I would have liked. But Nelson's actually the place I've lived the longest. So, you know, provincial towns, sometimes there's this, you know, were you born and bred there kind of thing. Mm. And that's really changing in Nelson. We've got a growing migrant community in Nelson, a lot of people who moved to Nelson who didn't grow up there. And, you know, if anyone says, well, it can't be your home because you weren't born here, well, it's the place I've lived the longest.
Yeah.
So if it's not my home, where the heck is? It means I don't have a home yet. So I feel a deep connection to Nelson. You know, we're talking to someone the other day. We both agreed it gets under your skin. It's an amazing place. And sort of once you're there and settled, there's nowhere else I'd rather be.
Mm. How do you compare a provincial town like Nelson to Auckland and Wellington? So what are the pros and cons of living in both?
Yeah, well, Auckland and Wellington are quite different as well.
Mm.
You know, Wellington, while it is a city, it's a small city and it still has a lot of that interconnectedness. You know, in Nelson, I can hardly go anywhere now without someone recognising me. It's mm-hmm. a small place. Everybody knows everybody else. And that has pros and cons. It means that the community comes together when things go wrong to support each other and mm-hmm. you get that really strong sense of community. It also can mean, you know, people don't always get on so well with each other and that can create tension in communities. Yep. You know, in a place like Auckland, I think it's so easy to get lost in that massive city and really hard for people to find the place where they feel that it's their place. You know, within Auckland, you do, though, have lots of communities that do amazing work together. But for me, I prefer a smaller place because I feel more connected to the people around me.
Mm-hmm. And you studied a Bachelor of Music at Auckland. What drew you to study that and then later work as a union organiser?
Yes, so I studied music. I also studied commerce. I still haven't actually officially signed off that degree. And so I had a plan to work in arts management because I am a musician. I never wanted to be a musician that worked as a musician, but I wanted to work in the industry. And so that's why I thought, right, I'll do some arts management work as well. Ended up taking papers in HR and employment relations, employment law, and realising that actually I was really drawn to, the role of things like collective bargaining, you know, working in a community together to make change in mm-hmm. your workplace and, kind of drew me into that space. I'd always been a union member and realised that actually I could probably do that work. And I loved union organising, really, mm-hmm. Challenging work at times, but great work, really, really enjoyable work.
Yeah. And I guess, you know that you're doing something to fight for the people that.
Absolutely. And it's when you see, for instance, attacks on workers' rights and things and just working with workers to organise to push back on those changes, we're seeing a lot of that at the moment. And so I take my hat off to all those union staff and delegates who are out there doing that work because you need a big voice to be able to say, actually, all these cuts to workers' rights are terrible for workers and that voice needs to be heard. And the voice of the workers, the ones affected, needs to be heard.
Yeah.
And so it's a real privilege to do that work.
Mm. And when you were doing your Bachelor of Music, what were your main focuses? Like, what were your main instruments that you played, or were you a singer?
Yes, I'm a singer.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't study singing. I took papers in things like choral studies and conducting and music education, and I was taking the children's choir at Auckland Cathedral at the time and singing in the New Zealand Youth Choir. So where I considered my house, you know, to have a tiny little specialty would be taking children's choirs and particularly church children's choirs. So I've also worked in Nelson, just in a very, very part-time role, taking the junior choir at Nelson Cathedral. A few years ago I did that as well. So I love church music and I grew up singing in a church choir. My mother is a church musician. She's an organist.
Yep.
She's a much better church musician than I am. But, I just love the music. I love the community that it creates. And seeing these little people learning to participate in a choir, learning to become excellent musicians. And I've seen some of the young ones I've trained go on to actually have professional music careers, and that's so satisfying. I knew I was never going to do that. It wasn't something I wanted to do. I knew I didn't quite meet the grade to do that. Mm-hmm. And so seeing these young people then grow their skills and actually win awards for songs they've written and things like that, that's really satisfying.
Oh, nice. And tell me about your work sitting on the board of the Nelson Environment Centre and the Nelson Women's and Children's Refuge.
Yeah, so I held those two governance roles for a few years, and Nelson Environment Centre is New Zealand's oldest environment centre and has had a real program of work around waste reduction. When I joined the board, it was reasonably early on when the Environment Centre had started a food rescue program. And so we run a program called Kai Rescue, rescuing food from supermarkets and restaurants and then redistributing it to the community. You know, lots of teething problems there. Yeah. You know, it's always a hard program to get set up. It's a great program. It's still running. They're really challenged by funding. Yeah. And I mean, that's one of the things I'm disappointed in this government about is, you know, you have food banks and you have food rescue programs that can help get food to people. During COVID and during our time in government where there were cost of living challenges, we got extra funding to those organisations so they could get that excess food and get it to people. It has a waste reduction component, and it also helps feed, you know, people who are struggling and they haven't had that extra support. And it's just a no-brainer in terms of making sure that, you know, food isn't wasted, doesn't go into landfill, but it can actually go to people who need the food. Yep. So that was a really enjoyable experience. Sitting on the board of Women's and Nelson Women's and Children's Refuge. Yeah, look, that's tough work, and the board members don't do the tough work. It's the staff and the volunteers that do the really tough work. But you do hear and see, you know, the nature of that work and just how much family violence occurs in the community. And also we were party to a lot of the discussions around how the all of government approach was working in terms of government agencies working together to share information and to have a shared approach to family violence. You know, you might have a family where it's happening and there's a provider that can support the person who's, you know, perpetrating the violence. There are people who can support the victims, people who can support the children. Sometimes getting the marae involved was a way of actually breaking through to a whānau who hadn't actually engaged with any other services, but it was the marae where they actually could engage and making sure that health are at the table and police obviously have a role to play. And yeah, so there was some really exciting work happening, and a lot of that is still happening, but making that really work really well for the whānau affected is just that's ongoing work. And unfortunately, we continue to see like high rates of family and sexual violence in New Zealand.
Seems to be getting higher and higher, actually.
Yeah, and unfortunately we're seeing it happen with younger people, particularly in the sexual violence area. That really concerns me. Yeah, you know, here in Wellington, you've just obviously got the news about
Respected
getting their funding cut. And that means there's no provider in that area here in Wellington. And like that's unacceptable.
Yeah, I agree. So what drew you to politics?
Well, for me, what actually drew me to politics, the first time I got involved in a political party, I sat and watched the 2005 election night results coming in by myself in my flat drinking a glass of red wine. And I knew some of the Labour Party activists at the time. And I watched the then party president, Mike Williams, on the TV as we were looking like we were going to lose to the National Party. And he talked about how, well, we haven't got the big booths from South Auckland in yet. And all of a sudden they came in, and then the vote switched and Labour pulled through and won that election. And I realised that all of that work that you can do, knocking on doors, delivering leaflets, talking to people, making sure people are enrolled, helping them get to the voting booth, that it makes a difference. It can be the difference between a win and a loss in a really tight election race. And I thought, I have got to stop sitting on the couch, caring about this stuff, yelling at the television, drinking red wine, by myself like a loser and do something. And so I joined. And the story goes, for many of us in the Labour Party, that you join, you go to a meeting, you become the branch secretary, and then you become the rep on the other committee. And then, you know, I wasn't joining to become an MP, like I genuinely wasn't. And it wasn't till I moved to Nelson, did some student politics in Nelson, got involved in organisations in Nelson, saw the issues in Nelson, and people said, you could do this. And I thought, actually, yes, I could do this. And I want to do this as the Nelson MP because mm-hmm. I care about Nelson. And we've got huge issues like in housing, for example, in Nelson. And I thought, yes, stuff it, I should do this. And I'm really glad I have. It obviously, you know, huge challenges and there's personal cost at times, but it just, for me, it's just been one of those things that was a bit of an accident, but a really happy accident.
Yeah, I guess that's a good way to get in. You like ease yourself into it by seeing it on the outside, and then you just get a bit more involved and a bit more involved.
Yeah, and I'd say to all those people, regardless of what political party you support, if you're sitting on the sidelines just yelling at the television hoping that that will help make change, yeah, get involved.
Yeah.
It's actually not that hard to get involved in a political party and just, you know, reach out, and you'll find that MPs and candidates and political parties, when you say, hey, can I volunteer and help out, you'll be welcome
yep.
with open arms, well, you should be. Yep. And I know at the moment we've got volunteers just coming in every week in Nelson for the Labour Party because people desperately want to see a change of government. And mm-hmm. so they're just, yeah, volunteering all the time, they're choosing to do so, and it's a great way to participate. And sometimes if you volunteer and then you hang out in the party for a while and you have great skills and people notice, that's when you could end up doing something else. It could be being a staffer, it could be being an MP, it could be being a city councillor. There's yeah. lots of roles that you can actually play within the political system, not just being the person out the front as the Member of Parliament.
Yeah. One of my cousins actually used to be volunteer for Chloe Swarbrick's party up in Auckland when he was studying up there, and he moved to the UK last year, but because of all the connections he made through the party, he's doing some type of remote work for them while he's living in the UK. It's like IT stuff. And I was like, oh, how do you get to work for a political party while you're on your OE? Because he's still looking for a job over there. So he's got this to time over. And he goes, oh, because I got to know lots of people that work there and they offered me this job in the meantime. So exactly yes. what you said, that you make all these connections and you're not just a volunteer and then once you're gone, you're gone. It's like yes. if you've got the no. ties there.
Yeah, and if you've done a good job and you've respected yep. that. So two of my staff have worked as volunteers in the party, and one of them, she's now actually gone on and she's working part-time for me, and she's now an elected Nelson City Councillor as mm-hmm. a Labour Party City Councillor. Mm-hmm. So I don't think she necessarily saw herself going into a public-facing yeah. role at the beginning either when she first got involved. But what happens is as you get older, you get more experienced, mm-hmm. you get more confident, you build the relationships and you start to realise, hey, actually, I could do that too.
Yeah.
And then people see it in you and say, hey, you could do that. And then you realise, actually, yeah, I could do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think if I asked her 10 years ago if she'd do it, she'd probably look at me with horror. But now, absolutely, she can do it. Yeah. She's growing the skills and, you know,
she got the right experience. Support around her to
absolutely.
Do it.
Absolutely. So yeah. I think, you know, I think don't feel like it's this big scary world mm. where you have to have all the knowledge either. You can genuinely just be the person that delivers the leaflets. That's fine. If that's all you feel like you want to do, you can be that person. Yeah.
So how do your values align with the Labour Party?
Oh, you know, really easily. For me, it's about people and it's about communities and making decisions that are in the best interests of everybody, and, you know, looking at equity issues around things like health and education and housing. You know, I firmly believe that everybody has the right to a decent life, mm. you know, a decent home, a strong family and community, you know, access to education and a job, good healthcare. All of those things. And I do believe that, you know, the state has a role to ensure that that happens for people. It's not okay just to leave it to the market and the private sector and hope that everybody's going to get access to those services, because that doesn't work.
Mm.
And so for me, you know, growing up, I had a lot of opportunity. I came from a family where we had a lot. And then when my parents separated when I was 10, we became a family that didn't have a lot. And we were lucky because my mother was able to work, that we were able to survive through that.
Mm-hmm.
But we also had a strong church community that provided support to us, and family and friends that got in and provided support. But if we hadn't had that, we would have been stuffed. Mm. And it was at the same time that the National Party cut benefits in the 1991, I think, budget. Yep. Now, we weren't on a benefit, so we weren't affected. But I remember watching that happen and think, I was 11 years old and thinking, there'll be people just like me whose mothers don't work who are literally going to have the weekly amount of money they come in getting cut. How are those kids going to eat, get shoes to wear to go to school?
Mm.
You know, how are those families going to pay the rent? You know, my mother wasn't a solo mother by choice. And she became a solo mother to five children, and we would have been on a benefit we would have been on a benefit if she hadn't been able to go back and work as a teacher. But that then meant she wasn't at home after school, you know, and she hated that.
There's always a sacrifice.
You know, and so this whole idea of blaming people for these circumstances, and ultimately it's children who pay the price.
Yep.
You know, we didn't make those choices or those decisions. Why, you know, why should kids not have to eat because of what adults have done? The state has a role to make sure that those opportunities are there for everybody, and that we also work towards, you know, equal outcomes as much as we can too.
Mm.
Look at healthcare, and, you know, Māori have lower access to healthcare and they have lower life expectancy. I've said this in the House. As one of New Zealand's leaders that gets to vote on the budget and legislation related to health, it is my responsibility to make sure we're making decisions in the best interests of every New Zealander. That means if you can see a very clear inequality, you know, between groups of people, you must work to correct it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not okay for Māori to have lower life expectancy than the rest of New Zealand.
Mm.
It's just fundamentally not okay. And how can I sit there and say, oh, I'm going to be an MP and collect the salary and not work to do something about that? Just fundamentally wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
fair enough. That's why I'm a Labour girl.
Yeah. Also, on that note, your grandfather was considered for the Wairarapa National Party seat many years ago. Has it ever caused conflict within your family that you're part of the Labour Party?
I wouldn't say conflict, but I do get a bit of teasing. So that's on my mother's side of the family. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my mother would say that I don't think her father was very impressed when she was at university and had Labour Party signs on her fence. And so, you know, on my mother's side of the family, there's a mixture of Labour supporters and National supporters amongst aunties, uncles, cousins and things. On my father's side of the family, it's mostly Labour support, a little bit of Green, occasionally a little bit of support for National, but mostly Labour. And so I get a bit of ribbing from my cousins. You know, they'll give me a bit of stick over things that they disagree with. But there's a genuine respect amongst us all that we're all decent people and we have some different views on how to get things done. My mother thinks that her father probably wouldn't be overly happy with the current National Party. He was opposed to the Springbok tour. Mm-hmm. He would have sat in that caring conservative camp, you know, that came from an Anglican background that was, you know, quite committed to social justice.
Yep.
And so, yes, more conservative in some elements of social, you know, social choices and the like. Obviously, this was way back in the 70s and 80s, so a very different time. And so whether he would be a National supporter under this framework that we have right now, who knows?
Yeah.
I didn't know him well enough to really know. But I'd like to think that the values that he gave my mother have then shaped me, and that a lot of that is genuinely about what is fair for people, regardless of which party you might align with.
Yeah. And becoming an MP in 2020 during COVID must have been quite interesting, going through, you know, a 1 in 100 years crisis, as well as being the first time that you enter Parliament as well. How did you campaign with all the lockdown happening all around us and social distancing? And then once you got into Parliament in 2020, how did your duties as an MP during lockdown and social how did you navigate all of that?
I look back now and you kind of have forgotten elements of it, but I look back now and think, it was weird. So doing Zoom meetings, so meet the candidates, Zoom meetings, but also, you know, instead of doing a, hey, come and meet me for a coffee and a cafe meeting, have a Zoom chat with me.
It's just not as personal, is it?
It's not. I think, though,
It did open up some opportunities for a different type of engagement. So I was, you know, my house is quite small. It's 80 square meters. And so my husband and I were working, because I was also working while I was campaigning. So we were working out of what is quite a small room, the size of this this studio we're in. So my husband, when I was on a Zoom call sitting right next to him, he would have his earpods in.
Oh, trying to do his work.
And some noise cancelling, like 3M headphones sitting over the top. Right? So he'd do like double whammy sound control, so I could do all my Zooms because I was on Zoom all the time, either for my job or for the campaign, because I was working 20 hours a week and then spending the rest of the time campaigning. Mm-hmm. So I was doing this all from this tiny little space, and we're all over the top of each other. And but then, you know, get to Parliament, the lockdown's over. But then the second lockdown was awful. I think for a lot of people, the second lockdown was much harder than the first. And certainly for Auckland, that's the case. They were in lockdown for such a long time. We had this thing called virtual house. And so you only had to have a certain number of people sitting in the Parliament. And so that was obviously our Wellington MPs. They didn't want us flying around the country because that can spread things. So I was having to do speeches into the Parliament in this little tiny room. And there was this one night I had to do a 10-minute speech on a biodiversity bill of my colleagues, like at 10 to 10 at night. And my husband was in the room next door trying to sleep. And I'm literally shouting into a TV screen that's then being broadcast into the Parliament. So everyone in the Parliament can see me on the screen. Mm-hmm. And then it's you know, broadcasting live on Parliament radio and TV as well. And then I had to do a big 10-minute call, and then I got off and I get this message from the whip saying, oh, just a short call on that one. So I didn't need to do the full 10 minutes. And it was just, you know, it put strain on everything we were doing. But from I guess it was also, that was the time when people started to fray a bit around COVID, and people got frustrated with government, with COVID itself. Cost of living challenges were starting to become, you know, an issue. People were disagreeing in terms of the approach, and yeah, it got really tough for everybody. Mm. Let's just be honest, for everybody found it tough. And when you're a leader in that situation and you believe quite strongly that actually we have a duty, again, this is where my values come in. We had a duty to protect our most vulnerable people. Mm-hmm. And again, I'll talk about that same staffer. Her little boy had cancer. Aww. And, you know, his immunity was terrible.
Yeah.
You know, and that's one of the reasons why I supported vaccination, is it's not just vaccination for me. It's
everyone.
It's protecting everybody. And so it was, you know, a lot of really difficult conversations, having to show that leadership while people were also getting really frustrated with the government response. So, you know, I do think, though, if you're an MP and you've survived that and you've managed to come out the other side, you can survive anything.
Yeah.
You can survive anything. I think that's the challenge in politics, is that you're never going to be able to please everybody. Your job is there to serve your community, and you will make decisions that you believe are in the best interests of your community. And sometimes you'll get it right and sometimes you'll get it wrong.
Mm.
You have to be prepared to say sometimes when you have got it wrong, you learn from it. And you just have to accept that as part of being a leader.
Yeah.
That's what we've signed up for. We are not perfect.
Mm,
and not everyone's going to love everything we do.
That's very true, yeah. How have you found being a woman working in politics? Have you noticed men being treated differently to you? And if so, how do you deal with it?
Oh, sure. You do notice it from time to time. I think things have gotten a lot better in terms of how politics operates. I would say, though, the previous parliament, there were more women, and question time didn't feel quite as ugly as it does at times now. It certainly feels more adversarial. There's a lot more, it doesn't feel quite as pleasant being in the debating chamber as it did when we were in government and we had more women.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think there's still more work to do. You know, if you look at the Reykjavik Index, which is a tool they use to analyse people's views of women in leadership.
Okay.
And what they're seeing is, particularly amongst younger generations, amongst young men and young women,
a growing trend that people don't necessarily believe women have a role to play in leadership.
People still think that.
Well, actually, it's so what the trends are showing is it's getting worse amongst the younger generations. Mm. So, you know, the impacts of things like social media, people like Andrew Tate, all of that influence.
The manosphere.
Is actually having an influence on how people see women as leaders. So actually some cohorts of older men are more likely to be quite comfortable with women in leadership than some of the younger ones. And so that worries me. And I think that's where we as women leaders also have to be willing to say, okay, what's caused that? Mm. Because men have a role to play in leadership too. And I think it's important that when women push for more leadership, it's not saying we want to take that away from men.
Mm.
And I don't think that's what women are doing, by the way.
No.
But I think somehow that might be how some men perceive it. And so what we're wanting is equality. Same opportunities. We're not wanting to say, hey, let's have 80% of the parliament women. That's not what we're saying.
Mm.
50-50 is what we want. We want that equality. And so there's so many ways, though, that women still don't have equality. So if you look at family violence, sexual violence statistics, income, home ownership statistics, so many different ways that you measure men's and women's equality, men still, do so much better in so many of those statistics than women do. And you hear through research that a lot of young men think it's gone too far, and it's like, well, it's that feeling that if one group gets something, it's being taken away from someone else, and that's just not the case.
No, it's not.
But we need to be willing to understand why it's being felt that way and work to address that. But I don't have a special magic bullet answer to that. I'm not going to pretend I do. Sorry.
Yeah, I think it's the way social media and the way people like Andrew Tate and all of those people involved in the manosphere, how they make it come across, and somehow all these younger men seem to get brainwashed into thinking that women are trying to take away their power or take away their jobs. Even though, when you ask them, where are the facts? They'll have no facts to give you.
Mm.
But it's getting fed into them by, scrolling on their newsfeed or whatever podcast they listen to. So they just have it in their head from somewhere that this is what's happening.
And the algorithm has a role to play in that, right? Because it continues to feed you the same information. Yep. Once you've clicked on it, it'll take you down that rabbit hole. And that's the challenge. And that's why things like, how much access to social media do young people have is actually a good conversation. Mm. The role of schools and communities and educating, let's be frank, what's the role of same-sex schools? We've got two in Nelson.
I've always wondered that.
I do support the schools, and we've got those two schools are great, but what I really am happy about is they've done a concerted effort to work together, so to have a lot of shared programs together, because the schools are literally next door to each other. So trying to have a shared timetable so that they can share some classes, doing things like a shared school production, all of those things, as much as they can work together, is great. Because when you kind of segregate women and men from each other in a way, I think it can create that kind of strange, lack of understanding between everyone. I'm one of five children. I've got three brothers, and sure, we've all butted heads with each other, but I think coming from five of us, there's 6 years between me, the oldest and the youngest, so we're all quite close in age, and I think that's probably helped us all have a quite measured response to this issue. I want my sister and I to thrive, but I want to see my brothers thrive too.
Of course,
I want them to have good incomes and great jobs and leadership opportunities. I don't want that taken away from them. I just don't want my sisters and I to miss out.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's very well put.
Yeah.
How has your union background shaped your politics, and has the reality of governing forced you to rethink any of those instincts?
No. In fact, more. So for me, it's about that power imbalance, the power imbalance between a worker and their boss. And there is a natural power imbalance, but there's a natural power imbalance in many parts of life between a teacher and a student, between a landlord and a tenant, in some ways, sometimes in some elements of health between a doctor and a patient. You know, there's, and this isn't being critical of any of those powerful roles. It's just recognising that across society we have power imbalances. And so when you're a union organiser, you're working to break those down. Same thing in politics. You're looking to say, okay, how can we make society fairer for people so that they can participate fully in society? Mm-hmm. So it just aligns really, really nicely. And it's taking what you do in employment relations but applying it in many, many other parts of your world.
Yeah.
I don't like that idea that, you know, you just have sort of top-down decision-making. It, ultimately, you do have to show leadership and make a decision sometimes, but the political process and the parliamentary process should be inclusive, should allow people to have their say.
Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. And there's a lot more that can be done to make that happen.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, and I guess that's what the union does. It listens to the people that might not otherwise be heard, and it gets their voice across as well.
Mm.
You won the 2023 election by just 26 votes after a recount. How has that result influenced your campaign and your community engagement going forward?
Well, obviously that was a really tight race, and, you know, you know, it was a couple of weeks of very anxious waiting for me. I mean, one of the things that's probably really important to recognise is that the party vote, how the party vote is going, plays a big impact on how a seat goes as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was really important I didn't take that personally necessarily. People were making a vote against Labor, but not necessarily against me. There would have perhaps been a little bit of that, but that wasn't the feeling I got. It was okay, we want to vote for a different government. And so those who do a two-tick, which is most people, changed their two-tick from two-ticks Labor to two-tick National. So that's what happened. Having said that, I think as a Labor Party, so this is for all of us, we did do a heck of a lot of listening in the first year or two of opposition because we really needed to hear from people. I think there were some things that, you know, happened in terms of policies where people just felt like they weren't listened to. They, you know, we didn't take the people with us in those decisions, and I think you can look back and see some of those. I mean, things like water reform is a good example. People felt like their voice wasn't heard around water reform. And I, you know, and that was a challenge. I heard a lot of that. I pass it on through the system.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately you're a Labor MP, and so you do, you know, you get punished for the decisions that have been made that people didn't agree with. I mean, I, to be honest though, heartened by the result because I'm one of only two provincial seats in New Zealand that's currently held by Labor. The other one is a safe Labor seat. My seat is not a safe Labor seat. It's a marginal seat.
Mm-hmm.
It can go either way.
Yep.
So actually, we lost seats that were strong, safe Labor seats, and somehow I held mine. that's because I like to think that I work hard, and I have worked hard for the community for a long time, and we campaign hard. We door knock on thousands of doors. And, you know, I go to the Nelson Market once a week. I meet with constituents a lot. I take up those issues. And so, you know, I hope that what happened was people saw that even though they were a bit grumpy with Labor, people were still willing to vote for me then. And I think there's lessons from that, I think not just for me but for everybody. You've got to be embedded in your community. People need to see you. They Definitely. Need to know that you've got their back.
Yeah.
And that's the challenge when you're an electorate MP, because you're both loyal to your party, but you're also loyal to the place that's elected you. So I'm very clear that I am the MP for Nelson. Nelson has chosen me.
Yep.
A lot of people have voted for me in Nelson, though, because I'm connected to Labor. So it's not quite as clear cut as that.
Right.
But I am the MP for Nelson. That is my title, and I have to be fighting for Nelson. So sometimes that means really being stroppy with your colleagues that this is what Nelson wants.
Yep.
You know. So, you know, we've continued to work hard. I haven't actually changed my approach much because I think the fact that I won meant that my approach was working, even though it was a very tight margin.
But it was something you did write about it to get those extra 26 votes across the line too.
Yes. Yes, I'd like to, you know, hope so.
Yeah. Tell me about your previous role as the ACC spokesperson and your current oceans and fisheries, arts, culture, heritage and animal welfare portfolios.
Yeah, so four extremely different portfolios.
Yes, very different.
So yes, I held ACC for a couple of years. ACC is obviously a tanga for New Zealand. It's a really amazing system that we have, always things we can do to make it better. You know, really mindful that there can be seen to be a, you know, discrepancy between those who can access ACC versus, you know, similar conditions that go through the health system or through the education system. So you think about, say, people with a disability has a similar impact on their life as somebody who's had an accident, but the health treatment they get is quite different.
Mm.
And I think those are the kinds of things that, you know, need to be addressed. And how you do that is very complex. And but, you know, just seeing that inequity, I guess, between those who access ACC and those who access the health system. We're seeing this government cut disability rights all the time. There's been some more cuts proposed yesterday in legislation that are not great for the community.
Mm.
And, you know, that's an example where I think, yeah, ACC is great, but how do we make the rest of the system just as great?
Mm.
Arts, culture and heritage is obviously a background of mine. And so I've felt really comfortable in that portfolio. You know, not all of it is my, I'm not an expert in visual art, although I did study art history actually, so I'm not completely,
so you know,
I don't
it.
Know, I do know something about it. But, you know, so there's been parts of the portfolio I've had to learn about, but I've loved that portfolio. You just get to meet amazing people doing amazing things. That portfolio gets punched down on in a really inappropriate way. You know, art and culture.
Funding cuts, probably.
Yeah, well, art and culture is good for our well-being.
It is.
You know, there was research that
shows...
It's
good for mental health.
Yes. There's research that shows if you go to a concert, you feel happier.
Of course.
Yeah.
People wouldn't be spending money to go to it otherwise.
Yes. And then there's also an economic benefit from the arts as well. It's actually a growing, you know, multi-billion dollar sector. So, yeah, I love that portfolio. And I think there's a lot more we could do to support artists and to support... everyone to have access to art, right? It's, it shouldn't be something that's just reserved for the wealthy few who can afford it. Everybody should be able to have art and creativity in their lives. Animal welfare, I love that portfolio. I am one of, I'm not the only one, but I'm one of the Labor Party crazy dog ladies. So not a crazy cat lady, I'm a crazy dog lady. There's a couple of us. And so... there's been a lot of work I've done around dog welfare and a lot of things I want to be able to do in government. It's really good that this government has finally realised we've got a roaming dog problem in Auckland and put some resource in around changing the Dog Control Act after being asked to do so for the last couple of years. So they're finally starting to act on that, and that's good. So I really welcome that. But there's lots of other issues, like in terms of pork farming, that government didn't get things right. We obviously battled to keep the ban on live export of cattle by sea that we introduced. Government acted on greyhounds, which we supported. So lots of things to do in that portfolio. And then oceans and fisheries, I picked that up a year ago, but it makes sense for the Nelson MP to have it. We are New Zealand's largest, actually Australasia's largest commercial fishing port. So we've got a huge blue economy in Nelson, and that portfolio is the most complex in terms of legislation and regulation and also what the problems are and what we need to do about it. But there's opportunities as well in the ocean space. The health of the ocean matters. We can do a lot more to invest in the health of the ocean, and we can do a lot more to grow jobs in that sector, but particularly in the areas of science and tech.
Mm.
Yeah, I'm just finalising the policy in that particular portfolio, and I'm really excited about it because I think we can have a different approach to this government, to the oceans and fisheries portfolio.
Mm-hmm. And what's one issue that you personally really want to make progress on next term if you're elected?
Well, for Nelson, Nelson Hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So Nelson Hospital is one of the worst hospitals in terms of its physical condition. It's in really, really bad physical condition. It's crammed, it's leaky, old resources. So not a lot of people around the country realise this, but it's in really bad condition. I managed to secure support for full rebuild of Nelson Hospital of over $1 billion, a full rebuild. National have cut that rebuild in half. So we're getting half a hospital.
Oh, no.
So we're going to have work to do when we get back in government to make sure that whatever facilities are built in Nelson actually reflect the need in Nelson.
Mm.
Yeah, so as the Nelson MP, that's my number one priority. Probably my second and third priority too. Yeah, it's just so important
health
for our community. It's
so important, yeah. What's one policy or piece of legislation that you would really like to see removed or changed next term?
Oh, pay equity. That what the government did around pay equity a year ago was a disgrace. Putting changes to pay equity legislation through under urgency with no select committee inquiry and cancelling so many pay equity claims was an absolute disgrace.
Mm.
And, you know, we've already committed to bringing back pay equity as it was because the legislation is terrible. It doesn't allow for proper pay equity where you get to compare from one industry to another. The cancelling of those claims was just outrageous. And so all of those claims have to start again from the very beginning. So it's unforgivable.
Mm.
You know, so many low paid workers, most of whom are women in industries that are essential for New Zealand. I just still feel a huge amount of anger and rage, actually. And I still remember the day it happened. We just got notice here. It was on the order paper under urgency. And how could you possibly, first of all, make that change and secondly, not have the bravery to put it to a select committee so that people affected can actually talk to MPs about why it was so bad? They knew it was bad. That's why they didn't put it to a select committee.
Yeah, which is why they put it through urgency.
Just, it's unforgivable. You know, the women of the National Party should hang their heads in shame.
Mm. Yeah. How often are MPs allowed to put through matters through urgency?
So they can do it essentially whenever they like.
Mm.
They just have to get the vote of the House to support it.
Right.
And that's probably part of the problem is, you know, by convention, it should be genuinely urgent legislation. That's not what's happening.
Mm,
yeah. It's a way to circumvent the select committee process. And what we're seeing is a rise in the use of urgency by this government. But we use urgency as well. Every government uses urgency. But this government has used urgency more than I think any other government has, certainly significantly more than we did.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah. Mm. And it's the thing is, it's what you call the all stages urgency that's the problem. So you can do a first reading under urgency because you really need to get it to select committee, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, actually, this is important. We need to get it out to select committee so that we can, because we need to pass this quite quickly.
Yeah.
So let's do that. I don't have a problem with that. It's when you do all stages, which means you skip the select committee process and you literally just go first reading, second reading, committee stage, third reading, boom, 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 all done in a day, you know.
Oh, wow, in a day?
Can be a day or two if you're doing, you know, that's how quickly it can happen. So that's not acceptable unless there genuinely is urgency. And in those situations, you should actually be working with the opposition for the opposition to understand why it is urgent.
Mm.
And you should have a review period so that you can go back and look at the legislation and see, okay, there were some unintended consequences and we need to fix that.
Yeah.
There's also another thing they're doing, which is doing a shortened select committee process. So normally it's a six-month process to put a piece of legislation through the House and like in terms of the select committee time frame. They're pulling that back to 4 months, which means less time for people to do submissions, less time for the committee to hear the submissions, and less time for the committee to get advice from officials. That's what they're doing on the Fisheries Bill at the moment. Really complex piece of legislation.
And they're just rushing
it. And we're rushing it. Mm. And so we don't actually have the time to do proper consideration. So how's the select committee supposed to make good decisions on a bill if you don't have enough time working with officials to understand and make it better?
Yeah, yeah.
So those are the two things. So it's not just the urgency, it's the shortened select committee time frame as well.
Mm.
It just erodes democracy and people's confidence and trust in the parliament.
Yeah, yeah, very true. What have been, on a lighter note, what have been some of your funniest or most memorable moments in your political career?
Oh, that's a hard question. I mean, there's normally something funny every day. That's actually a really hard question to answer, probably because I just get so focused. I mean, funny moments in the house. I think, you know, Nicola Willis has had a couple of funny moments in the house in Question Time with Grant Robertson. I probably not good for air. It's, you know, every day something happens that makes you laugh. You have to find those moments.
Mm.
Yeah. But I guess I get myself into this focused zone, right? And so I'm just focused on the work.
Yep.
And I tend to get then really fixated on the work and just like in the zone. So I often don't take the time necessarily to think about the funny things. I'm sure something will come to me as soon as I get back to my desk.
Of course, of course. And to finish on a lighter note, since you've got a music background, if politics had a soundtrack right now, what song would be playing?
Oh, Burning Down the House.
Oh, no.
Oh, but look, you know, across the world we're seeing an erosion of democracy, right? And people not trusting democracy. And part of that is, you know, the role social media plays and the role of misinformation. And you have, you know, you have nation states actually working actively to undermine other democracies through misinformation.
Mm.
I think politicians have to own it a bit as well and go, okay, what could we do more to like increase the trust that people have in us? Part of that is by being personally and available in person. If people actually can sit next to you and look at you as a person and know more about you and actually meet with you over a coffee, you know, they might not agree with you, but
you'll trust them a bit
but
more.
You will trust it that actually they do still have good intent, even if you don't have quite the right, you know, you know, the same views on how to get there. So I think in some ways in New Zealand, because we're so accessible as politicians, I think that does help. But honestly, like just watching the House at the moment, the Parliament at the moment, we are literally seeing government ministers fighting amongst themselves at Question Time from different parties. And I was talking to a staffer who's been in and out of the Parliament building for decades, like since the 80s, and he just said to me today he's never seen such a bad government. And they're just like, they're in chaos with each other, fighting amongst each other about policies. And it's like, how does that help govern New Zealand for the, you know, like all this little side swipes at each other? And I can't stand it. I came to Parliament because I want people in my community to live in a decent house, not because I want to sit in the Parliament having swipes at people.
Yeah. It's a shame. Hopefully it gets better. All the best for the upcoming elections, which is getting closer and closer.
Just under six months.
Yeah, already in May. The campaigning will start very soon.
Yes, already started. Already, for me. Yes. Yep.
All the best for the elections, and it's been such a pleasure chatting to you today.
Thanks, Halita. It's been fun. Thank you.
That program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.